Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Almost Famous. In the first series of the podcast, I spoke to guests who also grew up with famous family members and discussed how it affected their journeys through life. In series two, I want to explore the subject of fame more directly by talking to people who've experienced it themselves and asking them how it has affected their own journey as well as the lives of those around them. My guest today is television and radio presenter Max Rushton. Max was one of the presenters of Sky Sports Soccer AM for 7 years alongside Helen Chamberlain. He has also hosted Sky's Premier League Prediction Show and Fantasy Football Club, as well as Call Yourself a Fan on BT Sport. On radio, Max has made a name for himself presenting shows for BBC Radio 5 Live and TalkSport, as well as being the host of the Guardian's Football Weekly podcast. He is, of course, also the voice of Gaviscon. According to Max's website, Julian Clary once described him as young and frisky and a cheerful, handsome man. So I'd like to give a huge and cheerfully frisky, almost famous hello to Max Rushton. Max, how are you?
Hello. Yeah, really good, thank you.
Just before we get into, I always like to ask what you thought of your intro. Before we do, I have to say, as I always do, the podcast is recorded at Factory Studios in London. This is called the Podcast Lounge. And if you guys want to make a podcast, but you don't have somewhere to make it, do contact them at factory.uk.com. It's a lovely room.
It's really nice. It's one of my favourite of the rooms I've been in today, right, which includes my bedroom, my living room, the gym, and a cafe down my street, and another cafe down my street.
It's in your top six.
It's one of my favourite, yeah.
All of our guests do say it's a lovely room. Do get in contact with them, guys. But Max, like I said, your intro, did I miss anything out? Did I cover everything?
No, I just running through a selection of TV shows that are no longer on or are living by their last legs. No, I think you pretty much, you got everything covered there. Yeah.
We did meet, actually, first on Call Yourself a Fan, which was a strange BT Sport quiz.
Really strange.
Quiz show between sets of fans.
Yeah.
We had a bit of a chat after that, but I also kind of have to address something because I, just to show how mortifyingly embarrassing I can be to myself, I actually contacted Max during the first series of this podcast.
Yes.
Because I'd seen something online where it suggested that he was Willie Rushton's son or grandson.
Grandson, yeah.
So I said, is that true? Do you want to come on the show? And he was like, no, it's not true. And I had to send a very awkward apology.
So,
text.
Yeah, I said on the radio once, no, I think someone had tweeted me going, how have you got any work? You're so shit. And I said, I'm Willie Rushton's grandson. And, you know, it's all, that's the only way you make it in this industry. And then it got added to my Wikipedia. And obviously, Wikipedia is quite a fun place. Like at one time on Wikipedia, I was simultaneously dating Louis Walsh and a member of the British National Party. You know, which is quite interesting because I presume, and I haven't really done much research, I presume the BNP is quite a homophobic organisation. I mean, I don't.
I
imagine,
would make that assumption as well.
I don't think they'll sue this podcast, but if they do, it's my fault. So I didn't see how that really tallied up that I was going out with Louis Walsh. And you know, a sort of far-right fascist.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Wikipedia's a funny place, but I'm not related to Willie Rushton. In fact, I was born Max Rubinstein and aged six or seven. Like, my dad was Jewish, but not practicing.
You're so sarcastic that I'm not even sure
this
is true.
This is genuinely true. About six or seven, so we was. My dad was Jewish, my mum's not Jewish, so therefore I'm not Jewish because it goes to the mother's side. But I think we got some death threats or something weird. And my dad was like, well, there's no point. We're not Jewish. Let's not have a Jewish name. So he changed it to Rushton. So it's complete manufactured surname.
And you were seven, so you remember that. Was that not a really weird time?
I mean, I don't remember that they didn't I got no death threats.
But you don't remember when you were, you know, you were old, at 7, you're old enough to write. So do you remember what it was like to have to change your surname and not really understand why?
I mean, vaguely. I don't really recall it being very stressful.
Right.
My sister had a handkerchief with R embroidered on it, so they decided it had to begin with R. And then my dad did this joke forever that he said he put a pin in the phone book, but he put it in the business. You remember the phone book used to be business and residential?
As in, not the yellow. Oh, so we're talking
like
about
the old phone book.
The old blue.
Yeah. It's for younger listeners, will mean nothing. But he said he put a pin in the phone book, but put it in business, and he stuck it in Ready Mix, which would have been a really great. Max Ready Mix would have been really. I'd be much more successful.
Yeah.
I don't remember it being strange or weird. I think probably young enough to just get over it. But it's nice when you get one of those emails or letters that says, we can trace your family, the Rushton family, back 400 years. And I'll say, look, well, good luck getting past 1986 because...
Well, frankly, if you were Max Rubenstein, it would have saved me from an embarrassing email exchange. So that would have been way better. Max, I always start with the same question.
Yeah.
Are you famous? Do you yourself think Max Rushton... I mean, you work in sports, so you should talk about yourself in the third person. But
of course.
Is Max Rushton famous?
Well, if you want any... you know, perspective on it. When I came into this wonderful, well, the reception to this wonderful room, the nice lady who's just brought me a coffee, I said, I'm here to do this podcast with Barnaby. And she said, are you Matt? And I said, close enough. So I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a weird word. I think it's a fascinating subject, actually, because of the number of people that want to be famous for fame's sake. And I guess I don't know if I ever wanted to be, but I suppose given what I chose to go into, to be successful in it, you'd have to have an element of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly don't. Listen, there are places where I get recognised, football grounds, the darts at Ali Pali. I made that mistake once.
Right.
But otherwise, you've seen me in cafes like no one. There are actual famous people in London, right? So if you are, you know, if you're wandering around doing a day, someone might say hello.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
So you mentioned there going into what you've gone into, you kind of aware that would potentially, if successful, which you have been, involve some semblance of fame. Done a bit of prep. You said apparently that you wanted to be Des Lynam, aged 8.
Yeah.
So that's in keeping with what you've gone into.
True.
So I think that's not necessarily down to wanting to be famous, but you also said that when you started your early broadcasting radio career, you kind of had some kind of, you felt, whether by choice or not, that you were becoming or trying to be a Radio 1 DJ of some sort.
Yeah.
And then also I heard that you did a Blue Peter screen test.
Yeah.
So I would argue potentially that especially those last two are kind of erring on the side of you know, very potentially very fame bringing jobs.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's never scared you, the idea of it, I guess.
No, not at all. But I've never taken it seriously. But I don't think I've ever been at a level of fame where it would actually genuinely affect your day-to-day existence. You know, there's never been anyone sort of with a camera outside my front door. I suppose...
Which shows you haven't got into enough scandals, as
well,
far as
exactly.
I'm concerned.
I was papped in the Daily Mail once, right? But that wasn't me, that was who I was with. And I'm happy to get into that.
Tell us more, of course.
So I
usually save the scandal question till end.
That's
but,
fine.
You know, you're looking like you want to tell us. Go for it.
Oh, it's just a funny story. I there's an actress came on Soccer AM called Jessica Lowndes, and she was in 90210, the new one, not the old one.
Yeah.
So I confess I wasn't.
It wasn't Shannon Doherty.
It wasn't Shannon Doherty, no. I confess I wasn't a sort of avid viewer of this, but she seemed very nice. And we got chatting after the show and she said, oh, you know, I'm doing this gig tonight. Do you want to come? And I was like, well, yeah, I was single. I had nothing to do.
Like a theatre?
No, she was a singer, actress and a singer.
Right,
so she's, but it, you know, she was this, it was like a T4, Channel 4 thing. And it was very stop start. And there were just lots of kids there. And I took a mate and eventually we were just like, nah, look, I can't be bothered to hang around. So I think we went home. I think I got a McDonald's, and then she texted me going, hey, we're going to this Chinese restaurant in town. Do you want to come? And I was like, I should really, right?
Yeah.
And there were like 25 people at this restaurant, and there was one chair opposite her. I'd been out all day. Like a friend of mine, she was having this kind of hen do, just everyone would turn up. So I'd been drinking all day. And I was pretty drunk. So I was more charming than I normally am. And I thought I was, but it seemed to be going very well. And she was sort of she was finding me amusing, which is rare. And she was sort of quite tactile. And then we started talking about music, which is not an area of expertise for me. And she said, "Do you know this song?" And I said, "I don't know this song." No, she went, "Have you got YouTube on your phone?" I was like, yeah, sure. So I handed her my phone.
Oh, God.
She pressed internet.
Oh, God.
And it was a picture of her face because I'd obviously been in the pub with my friend saying,
your mate,
"Look who I'm going to go and see later." And I was like, wow, that was just one of those moments where you were like, oh, can I take this phone and throw out the window in enough time? And she found it funny. Anyway.
Did you then have to very quickly just make something up, or did you choose to just go full honesty and hope for the best?
I just went full honesty. Yeah. Went, you know, fair enough. But anyway, so sort of very convoluted period of time where we never really dated or anything, and she was constantly being. This is actually the closest I've probably been to seeing this kind of world, you'd be at dinner and then like Steve Jones would turn up, you know, the sort of very dashing Welsh
now Formula One host. Presenter,
yeah. And then there was another where sort of Lee Ryan from Blue arrived. And I was like, this is totally ludicrous, right?
Because she's friends with them or they're chatting her up?
I don't know. I don't really know how it worked. I think there was... I don't know how these things arrived.
So, like, from extras. This is so extras.
It really, really was.
Like when Hale and Pace turn up at the Ivy and Ricky Gervais can't get in.
So I remember that... And it's just not my world at all. And I'm not just saying that to appear sort of grounded or whatever. It just isn't my world. And I remember we met the Steve Jones one. I was just like... He was late, and I was like, well, I reckon there's no one else here that's sort of competing for her. So I was like, okay, that's good. And then he arrived, and I'm like, oh, well, for goodness sake, you know, you can't compete with this incredibly attractive,
he is attractive,
you know, stylish, suave man. You know, I'm there in jeans and a t-shirt, and he's in some like night. He looks good in a jacket and jeans. Like, it's not.
And at that point, you didn't know that he was a far worse sports broadcaster than you.
in my
humble opinion.
Well, but you know, he's been perfectly successful himself.
He was good on T4.
Yeah, I mean, like when you invite him on this pod, don't play him that bit.
Edit.
I remember, you know, she was like, oh, let's go dancing. And I was like, let's go to the Roxy. Do you know the Roxy?
Max, I spent the majority of the noughties in the Roxy Rathbone Place.
It's
like
the shittiest downstairs plastic glasses, plays Living on a Prayer and Like a Prayer. It's like the perfect place. Yeah. And he was like, oh, I'm a member of the Grouch Show. Oh, and I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. So anyway, we went there and the kitchen was closed, but he magicked some ice cream up. And I just took it out of his hand and ate it and just went home and was like, that's it, done. And I woke up and my trousers were on the floor in the kitchen, and I was terribly hungover. And she sort of sent this message going, oh, I'm home on my own. I was like, oh, God, I've messed this up. But anyway, it just turned into this massive tease. And then it was like Lee Ryan from Blue was at this dinner. And I was like, this is total madness. But at least it'd be a good anecdote for later. And actually, Joel Dommett, you know, Joel, who's really nice. He was also chasing her at the time.
He
did like an Edinburgh show out of it. And he's obviously gone on to be hugely successful and good for him. And me and Joel were just finding this thing so hilarious.
Oh, so you two were discussing it at the time because you knew each other a bit.
We didn't know each other. This is how I got to know him.
Right.
We don't really know each other particularly well, but we know each other we just found this, we were just part of this ridiculous entourage of people. And I remember sort of hating myself, but also sort of fancying her. And then eventually we were just on Primrose Hill, lying on Primrose Hill together. And it was funny because she was like, okay, let's go out on a date. And I was like, oh, great. And then I was like, you know, where should we go? Let's go to Amsterdam for the weekend. She was like, cool. And then she's dropped it. She basically, I was out with a friend going, I think we're going to Amsterdam. This is really weird. And he was like, okay, great. And then she texted, went one of those long texts going, I think we should just be friends.
Right.
And I was like, all right, fair enough. And then the next minute, like the Daily Mail had this article going, is she going out with, I think I was described as sports pundit. And it was like, my friends were just like, what is this? This is totally ridiculous. And then I think I was going to go on holiday with her to Portugal, and then loads of people were going, and I was just like, I can't, I've got to stop. This is so just ridiculous. And I sent this really patronising long email to her going, I think you're surrounding yourself with the wrong people.
Oh,
you know, it was like really, it was like sort of quite embarrassing. But I think the right thing to do, I was like, she seemed quite nice, but she was in this world that was ludicrous.
So was it, I'm kind of confused. So did you, in hindsight then, when you met her after the show, was she flirting with you, or was it something that you initiated? Or was this
good
just
question.
Or was she flirting with you and then presumably doing that to every vaguely attractive, handsome presenter?
It's a really good question, because she was sort of linked to, like, England rugby players and just, like, a whole selection. I don't know. I don't know if it was part of, like, there was some PR person saying, I mean, obviously, that PR person can't be worth much if she thought I would be worth, you know.
Right.
I think she was just sort of...
Is she from LA? It's quite an LA thing.
No, she was Canadian, actually.
Oh, really?
I think she was sort of slightly confused as what she was doing with her life, and it was just, you know, this was her world. It was just really... For me, it was like a real insight into this world, because I can remember Lee Ryan... At the Lee Ryan dinner, which is an amazing
Lee
dinner.
Ryan, Wales, yeah. Do you remember his Wales and Dolphins thing?
I don't remember that.
He was
yes, I do.
After
9/11. Yeah,
what about the Wales and Dolphins
yeah,
the next day?
Yeah, it's true. But I remember him saying to her, should we leave for the Paps? And I was like,
oh, God.
What? There aren't any Paps. Like, no one knows we're at this restaurant. And then I think somebody had basically said, can you take a photo of us? So they left, even though he had been hilarious at that dinner and she'd found it ridiculous. So I think my reading of it is... and I may be completely wrong, and you'd have to ask her, is that she was in that world, and she knew she had to be in that world, but she didn't entirely want to be in that world. Mm. I saw it and, you know, have got some really good anecdotes out of it, but for, like, the 4 weeks that I was sort of trying to chase her, I was hating myself at the same time and thinking, you know, this is not... You know, my future wife is not going to be...
Yeah. From the remake of 90210.
Exactly. My actual wife is a primary school teacher in Tower Hamlets, and it suits me, you know, that is right for me, and likes watching Death in Paradise and going to bed at 9:30.
I think the Death in Paradise starring one of our previous guests, Ralph Little.
Absolutely,
But I think the irony of it is, my reading of it, based on what you've said, is probably a little bit that she liked you because you were the most grounded and least kind of... You know, saying stuff like "Should we go now to miss the Paps?" Out of all
no,
of them,
no, it was literally. It wasn't to miss the Paps. It was to
to get the
Paps.
Yeah, to get the Paps. Sorry,
yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, me and Joel were very similar, I guess. You know, in that kind of thing of just obviously we like. I fancied her, but I was like, at the same time, I was like, this is totally ludicrous.
Yeah, it's a bit crazy.
Yeah. I think that's probably the closest I've been, apart from, like, charity football matches. If you go off the pitch near Ronan Keating and Ollie Murs, lots of girls scream at you.
Yeah.
But they're not screaming at you.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, you know, you could try and sort of pretend
it
was
you. I've played in some of those charity football games only because I'm kind of... Omid Jalili used to get me to play in them because I play in goal. And I remember playing against the team from the BBC show Merlin.
Right, okay.
And the main guy who I think played the king in Merlin, I played football against a few times. And I just remember every time he tackled me or got the ball, just a huge cheer from these young screaming girls at the Valley, which is
fascinating.
Where it
was. Fascinating, isn't it? I mean, we did that. One of the last Soccer AM ones, a guy called Joe Weller, who's a YouTuber.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, I'd know... You know, I'm too old for YouTubers and YouTube. But, like, I think we probably got about 4,000 people there, of which 2,500 had turned up for him. You know, we were like an established TV show, and we got some really famous ex-pros there, but they were all for him.
Yeah. The only similar story I have to yours chasing the... I mean, I was going to say the famous girl from 90210, but I've never heard of her. But I'm sure she is big in the, you know, American...
Yeah, yeah, I think at that time...
I don't think I've told this on this, and I'll do it very briefly, but I was at an early noughties, after Mobo's Craig David gig at the Scala, right? Because I used to work for 19 Management for a bit.
Right, okay.
So I got there for a friend of mine at 19 who got us in, and we're just walking through. It's like midnight, because it was after the awards. Just walking through, I've had a few drinks, and my friend who I'm with bumps into someone he used to work with. So he's talking to her quite intensely, and the girl that she's with is Holly Valance.
Right, okay.
Right? So at which point, naturally, completely shit myself. I've got to...
Of course,
you know, I've got to talk to Holly Valance. She's, you know, I watched her in Neighbours to some degree. Yeah, yeah. She's since had that song where she was naked in the video. And they're like, oh, should we go and sit down and have a drink? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So they're still talking, and I've got to think of something to say to Holly Valance.
Right.
And this is...
And it's the polite thing to do, right? It's not like you're trying to talk.
No.
It's like you're duty bound.
But in a weird way... If I'd been maybe 8 drinks deep, then I probably would have performed better at this stage. But in my head, the first thing I think is, well, presumably the first thing that anyone says to Holly Valance is something about her career or whatever.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm going to go the other way then. And I ended up saying something so mortifyingly embarrassing, like sarcastically saying, oh, at least I'm not sat here with someone who used to be in a terrible Australian soap. Do you know what I mean?
That's like, really a bad
assuming,
line.
Assuming that it would be, she'd get the sarcasm and it would be okay. But it was just, of course, like you said, appalling. And she basically literally turned her back to me.
Oh, no.
So I think you performed better than that by getting at least a month out of it.
And she probably found more financial security with
well, she's that man. Holly Valance is with like a multi-billionaire. Man. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not here to question you know, your current account.
So how did you get into the world of broadcasting and therefore your slight levels of fame? In your word, slight levels, I would say, especially in sport, you're a pretty famous man, actually.
So I worked on the river in Cambridge as a punt chauffeur when I was growing up.
Every man in Cambridge does that.
Yeah. It's a rite of passage. Mm. But it's good money. It was cash in hand when I did it. And one half of your body got really in shape, right? You know, because you were like punting all day on my left side. Right side didn't get as toned. And obviously in the university holidays, you'd go back, do it, and go back to university. It was great. But then the sort of last year, you graduated and then you went punting for the summer. Just, I'll work out what to do in my life. But then you don't go back to university, so you become one of the weird guys who's still there in October, and then it's cold, and your parents are saying, what are you going to do with your life? And I think I did like 2 weeks work experience at an advertising agency, and I really hated it. And a friend of mine had guessed the email address of someone on Football Focus, a guy called Charles Runcie, but he hadn't pursued that. And he went, oh, look, email this guy. So I emailed this guy and said, look, here's my CV. I mean, it was empty. Mm. Can I come in? And I did 2 weeks of work experience at Sport Online, like the website.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 2 weeks, he brought me into the room and he said, look, you know, you can do the job. Mm. Like, it was, you know, listening to Five Live, write up the report for the website. Mm. Someone would check it, whatever. You can do the work. Work's pretty good. You know, obviously there's things you can learn. You've only been here 2 weeks. Everyone in the office thinks you're a twat. And I was like mortified. I was like heartbroken. Mm. But obviously, I was just really cocky, basically. I was just a bit of a twat. And
what do you think allowed you to feel even cocky going into a industry like that you'd never been in before?
I think part of it was a hubris that not everyone gets. And I went to Oxford, and I think you probably. I don't think you get told that much, oh, you know, the world's your oyster, or like you can do anything. But you are kind of told that a bit, or you get that impression, you know, because big employers go there to try. Yeah. And I didn't understand the jobs that people were going into, consultancy and things. I was like, I don't know what these are. But I think I probably left with a bit of that. And I probably was just a young, immature bloke.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if Oxford had anything to do with that, actually. It might have been just the same if I'd gone to any other university. I was just, hopefully I was nice and kind, but I was a bit of a dick. I think a lot of 21-year-olds are. So I think it was probably that I was probably tried a bit too hard, or I was a bit too familiar with people who'd obviously worked quite hard to get to that position. And it was a really, he didn't need to say that. I've had so many people do work experience that have been a bit of a twat, and I haven't at the end of it, because I don't like confrontation.
No.
I've just sort of let them go on their way. It's not really my role in the weird way that presenters are sort of left slightly apart, so you never really manage anyone, you're never anyone's boss, but people sort of have to do what you want. Mm. But it's a weird dynamic. So it's never really my role at the end of someone's work experience to say, don't do this or do this.
Yeah.
But I could help people a bit more by doing it, because it was really important to me, because it made me realise that the next thing I did was went to Radio Cambridge. And I had aspirations to get to bigger establishments than Radio Cambridgeshire, but there were people there who loved doing that and were very passionate about doing that. And you sort of need to respect that. That is, you know, people really work really hard to make some really good. Actually, some local radio is brilliant, and some is bad, and some is brilliant. But some national radio is bad, and some is brilliant. And some people work really hard, and they weren't there because they hadn't made it and got to Radio 1 or Radio 4, Radio 5. Some of them had got there because they liked being there. And I think that probably, even though I had aspirations to go beyond that, made me realise that actually, I didn't really know anything. Mm. And so when I next went into places, I was sort of humble and, or more humble, I guess, hopefully, yeah. You know.
So that kind of brutal feedback
yeah.
is a real positive in terms of allowing you to learn what it would take to, or what not to do
yeah.
when going forward.
Yeah, massively important.
But,
I mean,
but you managed to, sorry to interrupt, but you managed to, I'm intrigued as to how early on then, I mean, other than the Des Lynam, wanting to be Des Lynam at eight, how early, you know, you must have told that friend who got you the email address. You must have known for years then that you wanted to get into that kind of realm.
Yeah, I guess so. I just hadn't, I think I said I want to be Des Lynam because it was just an easy way to stop aunts and uncles asking yeah. you what you wanted to do with your life, right? Yeah. I've got an answer now, I'll say it.
Yeah.
It's quite a good answer.
Yeah.
People like Des Lynam.
They you really
know, did. That looks like a fun thing to do. But I didn't, like at university, I was the sports editor of the newspaper, but not in an aspirational way, just because it was something to do. And me and a Geordie mate would get a crate of beer and spend all night trying to fit the reports into the, you know, the software on the computer. But like loads of people there were like aspiring journalists, political and sport, and had, you know, contacts books with, you know, someone would have Pat Murphy's phone number. And I'd be like, or, you know, I don't have that. I'm just doing this to see. Yeah. I hadn't really, in retrospect, it was a really good thing to do. And like the guy who was the editor before me is the sports editor of the Scottish Sun. I think the one who was the year below me was the Times tennis correspondent, you know, like obviously a lot of people. So people from the pod, I think Jonathan Wilson wrote for one of them. Like lots of people have done that journey, but at the time I didn't think of it in that sense.
Yeah.
So then I just started doing local radio and doing little sketches for other shows and getting out in the radio car and reporting. And I just found it fun. And I think I did, you know, I had loads of existential crises about all my friends had moved to London. So I grew up in Cambridge. I studied in Oxford. Every single one of them went to London, pretty much. And so they're all in London. In my mind, they are all still being students, going out, having a wild time. In reality, they're in houses without central heating and they're all broke. But I didn't see that. I was doing like Saturday breakfast at Radio Cambridgeshire. So I would, at 22 or 23, I would be going to bed at 8:30 on a Friday night, getting up at 5 and walking in past people leaving nightclubs. And I didn't ever really like nightclubs, but I was thinking, what am I doing with my life? Well, I stood at a farmer's market in Huntingdon to report again on apples and thinking, what, you know, Peterborough's oldest lamppost. I'm doing a report on Peterborough's oldest lamppost. How am I going to get from here to anywhere that I really want to be? But I sort of said to myself, year on year, if I've got further. So my dad was like, why are you doing this? Why, you know, he wanted, like, he didn't grow up with a whole lot. He did like amazingly well to become a doctor and you know, didn't have teachers for one of his A levels. You know, like he got out of, he went to school in Old Street, sort of 5 meters from where I live, and he's like, can't believe I spent my whole life trying to get out of here. Except he doesn't talk like that anymore.
And it wasn't gentrified back then.
No, and it wasn't. It was a shithole. But I think he was like,
wanted you to get a proper job.
Yeah, he didn't want me to go on a flaky career. Yeah. And so, but I think year on year, I was like, look, I'll see how I'm getting on. You know, can I get further? Can I get another show? So eventually get your first show, which is like just a one-off 2 hours on an August bank holiday. And I was 5 till 7 in the afternoon. Like no one is listening, but I am absolutely bricking it, you know. And I did so much prep for that show and it was bad, but it didn't, you know, it was like, you have to do that. Like the terror of that, only replicated probably by the first ever Soccer AM I did, because I'd never done TV.
Yeah.
But then year on year, it sort of, I was doing okay. I'd done a few more shows, or I was getting better at reading the news, and I did this postgrad journalism degree, which actually wasn't very good, but it was a piece of paper that you learn media law and all that kind of stuff. And I think I went to BBC London. So the last thing I did at Radio Cambridge was the longest ever radio show. I did 121 hours in a shopping centre for children in need. It was brilliant fun, right? It was really liberating, because I think the thing about radio is if you can make it feel so relaxed that people don't think they're in a studio, it will be good. It doesn't really matter, people will be themselves, right? And that's what you want, whether they're funny or serious or whatever they are. You can get the most out of someone if they feel totally relaxed, which is why I think radio is much less stilted than TV, because as soon as you put someone in a TV studio, they're like, the lights are on, we found that was Soccer AM. It was so noisy until the guests came on, and then we wanted to listen to them, but they're like, why has it gone quiet? Then they shit themselves, and then they're nervous. Yeah. So year on year, I was getting better. I did that ridiculously long show. It didn't really get... It got a bit of traction, but it wasn't like... It didn't make me. But then I went to BBC London. I'd already got a job as a journalist there.
Right.
Started being a reporter. Occasionally got to be the sport monkey on Danny Baker's breakfast show. And mm-hmm. Danny's a total... You know, he's brilliant, right? And he was a very generous broadcaster because he knew he was good. You know, I had presenters when I was reading the news. I remember one presenter doing the Peterborough breakfast show saying, look, sort of, I guess he saw me as some sort of weird kind of threat. But he was like, I'm okay with you doing the jokes. No, I get it wrong. He said, I'm okay with you joining in, but as Tom O'Connor on CrossFit says, I do the jokes. And he said that with no irony. I was like, what an amazing sentence. Yeah. I didn't hate CrossFits, but it's not like on Curb Your Enthusiasm this happens.
It was a good 80s/90s daytime quiz show, as I remember it. Well, it just shows that ego exists all the way along the line. Yeah, absolutely.
And with producers and with cameramen and with every, you know, and in accountancy firms and in schools, ego is everywhere. I think ego is very much in presenters. I mean, they're a strange breed. I think I'm on the normal side of it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's probably not for me to say.
But also what I will say, so what interests me about not only the way you describe your kind of career so far, but also the way you are as a personality as well. I feel like your default setting is kind of self-deprecation, take the piss out of yourself, sarcasm.
And I've been told not to do that. Like, bosses have said, don't retweet insults. And you sort of hope your bosses are smart enough to realise that if a tiny egg with one follower is saying they want to fist you in the anus because you're a scumbag, right, which is one of my favourite tweets. You know, that doesn't mean you're not very good. But I have been told to be less self-deprecating, but it is a default setting.
That interests me as well, because I feel like the way that you deal with, I mean, we'll get onto social media, I think, but the way you deal with it, I think is in a similar way to, you know, the way James Blunt deals with it and has made a, you know, basically a rebirth of people's view of who he is, because he takes a piss out of himself in replying to Twitter. And I think you do similar. Whereas, for example, someone who works at your station, Adrian Durham, who I've been in a Twitter spat with before, he'll just bite and he'll just bite and bite and bite. And maybe, you know, I would say if I were the boss of TalkSport, and I know you work there, so I'm not going to, you know, you don't have to say anything, but I would be more worried about people who bite on Twitter than I would about people who take the piss out of themselves.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, everyone does their own thing, right? But I wouldn't disagree with
you. Yeah. But also in terms of what I was saying about your self-deprecation stuff, when you're talking about how you made, you know, and kind of also being very laid back, when you talk about the way you've kind of made it up at this point into your career or whatever, I feel like you talk about it in a way where you're trying to say like you almost stumbled into each thing. But what I also notice, I think, is quite a deep-rooted ambition
Oh, no. So when I got to BBC London, I was in the boss's office all the time saying, I want to present, I want to show, here's my demo, why am I doing this? There were like two or three of us who were pretty similar in sort of style as reporters. You know, I would be doing the breakfast shift and finish 4 till 12, and I'd finish at midday, and then I'd just be downstairs making demos.
Right.
I was sending demos to every radio station, you know, KISS, Virgin, Radio XFM at the time, Capital, and I remember KISS liked my demo, and then
Were you into dance music?
Well, I listened to KISS for an hour, and I met the guy, and I'm sort of proud of that. I sat with him. I just said, before we get anywhere, I'm really pleased you liked it. I want to hear what you think about it. But I would be the person saying, here's JZ. You know, this radio, you may go to another radio station, but I couldn't be at KISS. Then I went to Capital. They offered me a show. And then the guy that offered me the show left or was sacked or quit. Yeah, so that didn't come off. I had a pilot at Radio 1, which I just didn't nail. It was really frustrating. And, you know, and I probably wasn't right for it at the time. It was about the time probably just a year or two before Greg James, they got Greg in. But I was just so unfashionable and so uncool.
Right.
I just wore deck shoes and chinos when they really weren't cool. They might have come back in now, but like...
I think it's flares now.
Well, maybe, but like, I just wasn't quite right for it.
Yeah.
But I would have been able to, you know, if I'd been a bit luckier, if I'd nailed that pilot, they might have invested in me. I don't know.
Yeah.
So year on year, these things were happening. And then I remember So yeah, there was real ambition, and I think my ambitions have sort of changed a bit, but I still have that. I still get like real sort of a bizarre professional jealousy of anything on TV, because I from you know An Index Takeaway to Newsnight, I sit there and go, I could do that.
Yeah,
and then I think, well, actually, A, the person doing it is probably better than me, but also, do I actually want to be doing that? I thought after Soccer M, I'd do it for two or three years, and it would be a springboard to X Factor, and I would do that. And actually, you know, Dermot is brilliant at X Factor, you know, and has an ability that I wouldn't have to retain some credibility, but also take it seriously.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be able to take it seriously. Not that it was ever offered to me, but like, it is interesting that I still have that, but I don't. But I also have enough perspective, and I don't know if it's to my detriment, that if I'm annoyed that I haven't been given a show or someone else has got a talk sports show ahead of me or whatever, that I just am quite happy generally about life, right? And I
think... That's because you're in where you wanted to get in, but being able to still have that ambition,
but I've got some perspective. I've got ambition, but perspective as well, right? Yeah. So I'm not... It doesn't take my every minute. If someone is doing something that I think I could do better, I might think it, but then I just think, well, I love my wife and I've got a nice flat. And I think about all... When you asked me to do this pod, I thought what was really interesting was... And it was funny that you had Ralph on, and I don't know what Ralph said, but he got fame so young, and he got huge fame so young. And I think that is much harder to deal with, because by the time I actually got any fame, by the time of Soccer AM, I was 29.
Yeah.
I'd had like 7 years of local radio reporting of just a lot of shit, and a lot, like, I'd worked really hard to get there, that when any kind of fame came, it just sort of didn't... I was just older and, you know, I wasn't that mature at 29, but I was just... It wasn't like getting it at 15.
You were Harry Kane, Ralph was Marcus Rashford, basically, is what we're talking about in terms of the analogies of...
I was Ian Wright, wasn't I? I was even later than that.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, yeah, no, exactly.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In terms, I mean, you've mentioned Soccer AM a couple of times. I think what's really interesting, and it leads on from what you were saying about getting it at 29. So you're kind of more ready than you might have been 7 or 8 years earlier. But equally, you were thrown into... It's kind of a poison chalice in a lot of ways, in that, you know, from my recollection of it, it was a very, very successful show and had been for, what, 10 years by that point?
Yes. So Lovejoy had done 9 or 10 years.
Tim Lovejoy had done 9 or 10 years, and it was a very kind of cult successful show. And then Lovejoy left, and then Andy Goldstein did a year, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it was very quickly jettisoned.
Yeah.
But as someone with no TV experience, that's a very, I imagine that to have been a very, very difficult time. And I think you've even described it for us as just saying you were terrified by it.
Yeah. If Twitter had existed,
yeah,
then I wouldn't have lasted. Convinced about that. Because I wasn't very good at it.
And you did last 7 years.
I did 7 years. But if Twitter hadn't existed, so I started in 2008, 2009. Maybe Twitter did exist, but it didn't really.
No, it wasn't
what it was now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have lasted because I wasn't very good at the start. I was still learning how to do it. I wasn't myself. I was trying a little, like Tim and Andy were both quite sort of laddie. Excuse me, they were sort of quite FHM loaded, and I wasn't really that, you know, I'm a massive square, really. So it took me 2 or 3 years to be like, right, this is mine now. I can relax and be me, and people will like that or not, but that's much better than sort of trying to force being laddie about things, because it's just not in my nature. That's not a criticism of people who are, it's just...
Sure.
You know, I wanted David Attenborough on the show
and
Angela Lansbury and Carl Kennedy from Neighbours. I didn't want some cool rapper, you know, because it just wasn't, that didn't interest me. So it was really terrifying. I think I was probably lucky that Andy did that year, right? And I don't think he was, I think he was actually pretty good at it, really. And actually, I think what's interesting is, it's funny that I did the Blue Peter audition the day I got offered Soccer AM. It was a weird day. But like, and Blue Peter doesn't really exist now. Maybe it does, but
not
but
as
like,
it did back.
Not as it did. Yeah, and certainly it was already on the wane by the time I was offered it. Or I got to the last three of the interview, but I'd already agreed with Soccer AM. So it was a very strange day. But you look back with rose-tinted spectacles. So if you are now our age, well, Soccer AM, you were in your mid-20s when Lovejoy was there, and it was like, it was fantasy football, right?
Yeah,
it was like Badil and Skinner. Like, it was an amazing TV show, right?
Yeah. Well, I know David, and he definitely thinks it's fantasy football.
Yeah.
In that he's just a bit like, they ripped us off.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one has a, you know, if you take football and comedy, you're going to come up with the same gags.
Exactly.
But David and Frank, I don't know them well enough to call them, but I'd never met them. Don't know them to call them by their first names. But that was seminal TV, right? As a 16, 17, 18 year old for me.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And I think Soccer AM did the same. It was live and it was longer, so you had to pad it out. But actually, you look with rose-tinted spectacles. We used to watch some of the old shows, Tim and Helen, and be like, I mean, basically they were doing the same thing that we're doing. And like what they're doing now is pretty much the same.
It is,
but I'm not objective. I don't watch it, but I probably think, oh, my years were better than they're currently doing.
Yeah.
But we'd probably come up with the same gags because, you know, you're going to do a gag about VAR. There's like, there are a million you could do, but you come up with one and agree what's the best one.
Yeah.
And so...
And you're working to the same audience. You're working
to
the same audience, just a different generation, but the same audience.
Where I was lucky with Soccer AM was because Sky was growing and it was all about subscribers, the figures... I think the highest ever figures were when I was there, but that's not because of me. That's because we have more subscribers. Mm. The figures also dropped off while I was there because young people don't watch TV now, right?
No.
They just don't.
No.
And also, probably by the last year I did it, social media had got so big that even when I first arrived, if something funny happened in a League Two game, you didn't see it until Soccer AM the next Saturday. It was a clip show, really. Mm. It was sort of like, it'll be all right on the night for football with some guests.
Yeah.
But obviously by now, if something's funny has happened, everyone's seen it.
Yeah.
Everyone's seen that brilliant goal from Irish football, you know, being tweeted out a minute, that volley. It's an amazing goal, right? But we've all seen it. I know this is not very time specific, but, you know, John Stones falling over has been gift to death in the Carabao
and
Cup
straight
final
away
already.
As well.
And straight away.
Yeah.
So that really changes what they have to do as a show. But I was really lucky because that still existed. Sky was still growing. And, like, it was life-changing. I was so lucky to get that show because I made a show reel and I sent it to everyone and no one replied except for the Travel Channel who said I was boring. And Sky Sport, this old Scottish guy rang me and was like, what are you doing tomorrow? Come in for a chat. I was like, all right. I met these two old duffers who were Vic Wakeling, who sadly passed away, and Andy Melvin, who built Sky Sports from a porter cabin into what it is now. And we just chatted about Cambridge United for an hour.
Yeah.
And Soccer Airman, I'd been a fan of the week in the year 2000. I'd been in the Luther Blissett, you know, with my mates.
Oh my God, that's a clip that must be dug out.
Yeah. They dug it out on the first show. Right. But it's like, for them, at that meeting, they decided that Andy, they didn't want to keep Andy. So they were just sitting there going, supports a lower league club. So that's credibility already.
Yeah.
And has been on the show, right? They're just going tick, tick, tick. I honestly was like, I just lost the breakfast show on BBC London. I was still staff at the BBC, but I was like, oh, you know, the power boating or that 10-pin bowling competition or the pool one. I had no concept that they were thinking of something that big. So I was incredibly lucky to get it. I was pretty unlucky to lose it, but that's life, right? I was luckier to get it than I was unlucky to lose it, is how I see it.
We'll get on to losing it, I think, because I'm intrigued about that. But I think it's worth asking for people who maybe are listening. You know, let's say we've got some younger listeners and they aspire to the kind of career that you are in or the industry that you're in. What I'm really fascinated by is the idea that actually that almost kind of what feels to me like that mythical thing of if you can get yourself an in and then just totally self-promote yourself and send stuff out, that actually that can really work.
Yeah.
Which I think is, God, I really wish I'd had that belief, that kind of self-belief that you had when I was young, because I would have absolutely aspired to get into a similar thing.
Yeah.
But I think I know that I pretty much know that I wanted to be a presenter from when I was a teenager, but I was way too scared to tell anyone that I wanted to be a presenter because I thought people would say, well, that's such a fucking vacuous job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So firstly, brilliant to have that kind of not caring about that and self-belief. And then secondly, I'm intrigued to know, in that Sky Sports meeting then for Soccer AM, did you know that that was even a possibility they were going to offer you that job?
Not a clue.
And if you had, do you think you'd have been able to be as relaxed?
And actually, I had that chat for an hour. They went, look, we think we've got something for you. We'll give you a call in 2 months. If you get offered anything big, let us know. And I was like, all right. What is it? Maybe it's like an out and about guy.
Yeah,
maybe
VT
it's like,
guy, yeah.
Yeah, or like some goals on Sunday thing. I don't know. Like, I have no idea. Mm. And then the producer of Soccer AM rang me and said, do you want to go for lunch? So I said, yeah. He didn't really give anything away either. So I was just chatting away to him. But we talked for an hour and a half, so I thought, well, that can't be bad.
No, yeah.
And then they called me on like Wednesday. You know, I got a call from Vic on Wednesday saying, what are you doing on Friday? And I was like, well, I've got a Blue Peter audition. So then he's going, shit, we're going to lose this guy.
That's the best thing you could have said.
Amazing, right? Mm. So he was like, can you get in before? I was like, fine. So I got in before, and the funny thing about this is so ridiculous. The Blue Peter audition, I looked at the information, it said, and I was 28, 29 at the time.
Yeah, quite old for Blue Peter.
Yeah, it's a bring in a prop that represents your life. What? So I was like, I don't know anything. I was looking around the house. And years ago, a mate of mine.
Your punting stick, surely.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what that's called.
Yeah, I don't either. But years ago, me and a friend found anvils funny. And then he sent me one through the post.
As in anvils, the...
Like the cartoon,
the,
you know.
The cartoon weight thing.
Yeah, I think it's for like blacksmiths or something.
Right,
isn't it? We found it funny. We thought it'd be funny if we posted one because the postman would have a bad day. That's not very kind of us. So I had this anvil. So I put this anvil in a bag, got on the train to Sky, and then went in. And I was like, well, you know, there'll be a screen test or a pilot or an audition. And I just went and sat down. And he was a Geordie guy. He went, I'd like to talk about Soccer AM. I went, yeah? And he went, would you like to do it? So I'm sitting there going, I was like, yeah? And so he was like, I'd hope you'd say that. What happens if you get offered Blue Peter? I was like, well, I'd rather do this. I said, I hope you give me £1 million,
yeah,
but I'd rather do this. He was like, okay. And he said, what other work are you going to do this year? And I went, oh, I'll just do this work. I'll just do this to make it so good you give me a second year. He went, oh, I'll give you a 2-year deal. So I'm like, and then it was just after Hull had beaten Bristol City in the playoffs, right? Dean Windass had scored that volley. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't really watched the game. And he started talking to me about the game. And then I'm sitting there going, I've got to fucking get out of here. Mm. Before he realizes this is just like, what are you doing? And he said, do you want to talk about money? I was like, no, I don't, because I literally had no, I just sort of agreed to have with this agent. But I was like, I just don't, I wasn't really earning any money at the time. I'd have probably done it for nothing because it would have been great profile. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I don't know. And then I rang my agent. I said, look, I've got a 2-year deal. Do I have to go to the Blue Peter audition? He was like, yes, because nothing until it's signed is set in stone. Mm. So I go to the Blue Peter audition and there's me holding an anvil right? There's like four, there's four 25-year-old blokes and five 25-year-old girls and me. I'm just so out of place. I don't want this job. They've all got like photo montages of their whole life. This is the biggest moment of their lives.
That they all made.
That they all made. Yeah. I'm sitting there with an anvil. I'm right. And then at one point I'm like, we had to do this thing with water pistols. And this poor girl, I'm just sitting there with a water pistol going, blah, 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 blah. What do you think? And I just went, just like absolutely like soaked her. And then I was learning the history of Lego.
That will have been good, by the way. That will have absolutely been, will have gone down well.
Well, then I was learning the history of Lego.
Your level of not giving a shit will have absolutely gone down brilliantly.
Yeah, I got to the final three and said, I don't want it. Yeah. But like, if I hadn't had Sir Graham, I would have probably ballsed up that interview. Yeah.
History of Lego, sorry, I was interrupting.
That's right, the history of Lego. Then my agent texted me and went, look, this is what they're paying you for year one and year two.
Yeah.
And it wasn't footballers' wages.
No.
You know?
But in comparison to what you...
In comparison to what I'd earned before, it was like life-changing.
Yeah.
And I, like, my brain is like, it was just so much to take in one day. And like, Sky were like, don't tell anyone, please. Mm. Because I don't think they'd, you know, they wanted to get me sorted before they...
Yeah.
Spoken to Andy, and a friend of mine, Clive, was getting married, and he would like me and a couple of the other ushers or whatever were going to the pub to taste the beers. You know, why do you do? I don't know why you do that at a wedding. You know, you drink shit beer all
year. I'll tell you why it is, because it's so that the groom to be can tell his wife to be that he's doing something for the wedding when really he's getting pissed.
So after about three beers, I just turned to like two of my oldest friends I've known since I was like four. I said, had a really weird day, chaps, and I told them, and then I just shat myself a month and a half. Just, you know, there was no, like, we didn't really rehearse or anything, really, until like the day before.
Oh, right.
We like rehearsed a bit,
yeah,
and then we did the show. It was like 3 hours, and it was just like utter terror. I was like a rabbit in the headlights. It was terrifying.
Because I was going to ask, actually, because that you've described so that day to me is what I kind of describe as like the very rare occasions in your life which feel like the Little Mermaid moment where it's like she comes out of the sea or whatever and everything just comes together at the right time.
And also you sort of feel like you're watching.
You're watching yourself happen. Yeah, exactly. You're watching it happen from outside of your own body. And, you know, on that day, it's probably hard to get a reality of it. But the reality of it is, of course, that you'd worked for 10 years really hard in various different ways so that day could happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
and it could have happened at Radio 1, or if it hadn't happened at Soccer, maybe it would have happened at some other time. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. But then
what I was going to ask, just so I don't forget, is I'm intrigued to know, because then you mentioned how the next month and a half you were shitting yourself. I'm intrigued to know how long, literally, you think you were able to enjoy it before you were then like, the reality of this is killing me with fear. For me, it's usually about 20 seconds.
It's a really good question. I don't think it was very long at all.
Mm.
Because then your mind starts racing. Your mind starts racing sort of creatively, like, I've got all these ideas. I've got all these ideas for this show that I think would be great.
Mm.
And then you're like, I need to meet Helen. I need to meet the producers. And then, like, you went into the office. And obviously, people have been doing this job for a long time. And actually, even though the show's super fun, it's really hard work for producing APs who aren't necessarily getting paid loads of money. Mm-hmm. And it's not, like, in my mind, that office would just be people mucking about all day. And actually, people had work to do. So people and were in different points in their life. Some of them didn't love it. Right. And there were like relationships in that team of 20 that weren't great. So I sort of came in thinking, literally, it would just be like confetti and, you know, a
miracles,
ticker tape thing. But,
magic,
but like, that actually very rarely happens in any...
No, it's real life.
In any... Yeah, it's real life. And there are people not enjoying it, liking people, not liking people. So I think that for me was like a... I don't know why I presume... I presume because it was such a fun show that everyone would be so happy to be there. And most people were.
Mm.
But actually, you know, the breakfast show that I'd done at BBC London, if I look back, at a time that I did the breakfast show at BBC London, I was doing it with Joe Good, who is still at BBC London. There are two Joe Goods, and she's the one who was in Crossroads, right? So it was a really weird man. This, I was sort of 25 spotty, or 26, 27 spotty, unfashionable, sort of vaguely posh bloke, and she was like this former actress who wasn't sure what to do with her life. But we had this just team of everybody who got on amazingly well, and that doesn't happen that often in any bit of life. So So I sort of found that quite interesting at Soccer AM. And I was just in my own world of fear, actually. Yeah. Like, just so scared. Like, the night before, just couldn't sleep. Just woke up thinking, why am I doing this? Just trying to get through the first show. And I was so nervous. I dropped my phone in the toilet before the first show. And a mate of mine was getting married in Sweden. And that was brilliant. So I literally did the show and I flew to Sweden.
Right.
And my phone was running out of batteries. I didn't really have the address. I just thought, I'll look at it on my phone when I've got out. So I actually found my friends. And also, like, even though there was no social media, I was away from any sort of reaction from anybody. Mm. So I was just like, oh, I was like in a lake, Swedish lake, the next morning thinking,
What a weird weekend,
yeah.
And just before I go on to, like, what happened at the end with Soccer AM, and then we'll move on to other stuff, why then do you think, you said, you know, you thought you were bad at it for a while from the start. Why do you think they stuck with you during that period, other than giving you a 2-year contract, I suppose?
I think because they'd changed the presenter for 1 year already, so they just needed some continuity. And I think that was probably the main reason.
Right.
And I didn't rock the boat. You know, I was sort of very deferential to Helen, which is probably the right thing, because mm-hmm. she'd done it. She knew what it was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to compete, and she was really, really good at it. And I got on with the producer. You know, we didn't agree on a lot of things necessarily, but I wasn't a twat. It was that advice from, well, hopefully I wasn't. You know, like, so I was easy. I was good to work with. I was punctual and sober and friendly, you know, and I would.
Are you suggesting not everyone's punctual and sober, Max?
Well, you know, so I think those things really helped me, actually.
Okay.
But I think I was pretty lucky. I think really early on, they were thinking about, I remember the boss met my agent, was like, we're not sure this is working, after like a few weeks.
Wow.
And he rang me and told me, and actually that Saturday I was wearing a polo shirt that looked like it was like one of those old Lyle and Scott ones, but it looked like exactly like the B&Q
people in the
uniform.
Advert.
Like the black with the orange.
Right.
And and like we just got all these emails about B&Q, and it's really funny, and I just sort of, I think at that moment I was like, I can't believe I worked so hard to get here and I'm going to lose it. And I was just a bit like, oh, fuck it. So I found the B&Q stuff funny, and it was like a sort of, for me, no one else would notice, but it was like a changing moment for me.
Right.
And then we filmed me in a B&Q the next week before the show. You're like, oh, it's 5 to 9. Can I get off shift? And it was like, okay, I'm sort of starting to be myself. I was still...
Right, so a literal enabler for you to take the piss out of yourself that allowed you to then maybe be more yourself on the show.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. But also one of the most stressful times, surely, because I'm not sure if it will have gone out by the time this episode does, but we interviewed James Redmond, who lost his job after 3 months on SMTV Live CD UK.
Really?
And he talked at length about that and just how difficult that was for him to recover from.
Sure, because you've worked so hard to get that moment, and then it's gone.
Yeah, really similar thing. And so you mentioned how lucky you were to get it, but then you felt unlucky to lose Soccer AM.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, in my experience of broadcasting, and it's probably the same in lots of places, the boss who hires you likes you.
Mm.
And if a new boss comes in, then you're in the lap of the gods, because they've got their own ideas.
Yeah.
And the new boss of Sky Sports didn't think I was very good.
They might have got, they might have got the job by saying, I think it needs changes, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, Soccer AM was not that important to Sky. It was important in a way, but, you know, there were live football, Soccer Saturday, all those things are the drivers, right? That's why people subscribe to watch the football. But I think he had worked with Fenners previously, like they were similar age and stuff. And Fenners had come in to do fantasy football, which was a really good show. And so he wanted to change it. I don't think I could have done anything differently to change that. So he swapped us, and I went to fantasy football. And actually, I really enjoyed it. So like
that was a really good show. Actually, I really enjoyed that show.
It was like, this is your life for a footballer. And I suppose at the time I was like, I've swapped shows.
How did your ego feel? Like, how did it feel? Like, sure, because I reckon if you're anything like me, then I reckon there might have been a part of me that would have gone, fuck you. No, I'm not gonna take this other show. I'm just going to leave self-defeatingly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cutting off my nose to spite my face. Was there any part of that, or how did your ego feel at that?
Do you know what? At BBC London, I'd done the breakfast show for a year. Now, I was staffed, so I wasn't like a freelance presenter like most people are, where your contract runs out and you can go. They had to find a job for me. And I used to be the breakfast reporter, right? So that's going out in the radio car, reporting to the breakfast show. They got Paul Ross to do the breakfast show, and they said, Max, can you go and be breakfast reporter again? Mm. And I sat there going, God, that is so fucking galling. Mm. This is my show, and now I've got to be the funny guy in the radio car. And my first report literally was dog shit. Like, it's a local radio report, you know, picking up dog shit. And I'm like, are you fucking serious? Mm. Like, you couldn't write this. Mm. And I remember doing the report, and amazingly, I was this bloke... This dog did a shit. I'm there like with my. This isn't live.
So Alan Partridge. It's so Alan Partridge,
but it's not live. But I'm recording. I'm like, here I am, and I was like, excuse me, your dog's just done a shit, and you haven't picked it up, and I just wonder what you think. And he was like, oh, and he got flustered, and he picked it up with his bare hands and put it in the bin, right? And I'm like, you've just done it with your bare hands, like, yeah, whatever. And it was like such a brilliant bit of radio, actually, and I was like, this is galling for me, but listeners don't give a shit. No. They don't even think in that way, right? So. I sort of had that perspective to go, okay, well, this is what it is. And I suppose I don't do it all the time, but I try in my life to think, this is what I'm doing right now. So I'm right now doing this podcast. I want to have as much fun and make this as good as I can. Mm. And then when I leave, I don't know what I'm doing later, but like if it's even just cooking the pad thai I got on special at Waitrose, I'm going to, you know, like it's a good way to exist, right? So I remember I was away in the summer with my... girlfriend at the time, my wife now, we were in Vietnam, and I remember all this machination was happening over the summer. And
so is it like Chinese whispers kind of thing?
That kind of thing, yeah. You know, and I remember the number two at Sky saying, my contract was running out, and I was like, look, eventually, I rang him, I said, look, you don't owe me anything, but you got to let me know, because am I coming back, am I not? I really need to know, because... I've got to find another job. He was like, you are coming back. And he's like, can you tell me what it is? And he was like, I can't tell you what it is. And eventually, I was, do you know what? My biggest fear was it was Sky Sports News, because that would have just killed me, because that's just 5 hours of just tedious transfer gossip.
Yeah, it's not
stuff.
Your personality. It's
not for me. Mm. And then he said it's fantasy football. So I was so relieved. And then I went away and I remember like...
But by that point, so when he said you're coming back, you knew that it wasn't going to be Soccer AM still?
Yeah.
Right.
But I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know... And actually, so by the time... I remember meeting some people in Vietnam. We were on holiday in Vietnam, and some like fans of the show were like, oh, let's have a photo. Oh, I can't wait for next season, blah, blah, blah. I remember that really hurting, going, I can't tell them, but I'm not there. Mm. And Fantasy Football was a much smaller show. Mm. But like, they gave me a 2-year contract. You know, and it was talking about football. And actually, I hadn't really watched fantasy football until I got it. And I really grew into that show. My first reaction was, this is nowhere near as fun. We need to make it more fun. But actually, it was really interesting. And football, the story is really interesting. I love football. Really, and actually, I really liked that show. And I guess it was a bit more serious.
Yeah.
And that probably didn't hurt me professionally. And it's interesting because for the first few weeks of Soccer AM, when I wasn't there, people were devastated that I wasn't there. After years of no one caring, social media was like, where's Max? It's the end of the world, blah, blah, blah. And obviously now, 4 years later, whatever, no one cares. You know, no one is indispensable. You never are. It was, you know, I had 10 years at Sky, so I did fantasy football, then predictions. And for lots of different reasons, you know, Sky doesn't make that many shows like that anymore. Like, it costs a lot of money compared to the debate now, which is three people in a room have a chat, which is a radio show, really.
Yeah.
They didn't renew my contract. And I remember when they, you know, they got me into the office and they said, we're not renewing it. I was sort of not, I was bothered because obviously financially it was a big hit, but I was getting more fun out. And I'm not just saying this, but The Guardian was massive for me. Like, really loved doing that. Talk radio is, I really loved that. I'd happily go back there if they offered me something that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
But it was like it was, you know, you've got to have the perspective to go, I was there for 10 years. I never, ever thought I would be there for that long. It was life-changing for me, and I learned how to be good at being a TV presenter. It opened up lots of doors for me, so
yeah.
I'm certainly not embittered.
No, and it's definitely like I mentioned before, it's like the dream kind of story for people who aspire to that kind of thing, is how hard you have to try, and then suddenly when you almost like when you least expect it, it might all come
sure.
off as well.
Yeah.
This is the Almost Famous podcast, and we did in the first series obviously talk about the family members of people who've experienced fame. Other than you mentioned your dad wanting you to get a proper job, etc., but in general, how has you being on TV, being a celebrity or a famous person, affected your family? Do you have any siblings who have tried a different thing, or and what do your parents think?
I mean, probably almost made almost no difference to my life, I would say, to their lives. I think my mum got very excited when she thought I was doing a TV show with Paul Merton, and then she found out it was Paul Merson. They'd switch on the TV to check I was still alive on a Saturday. I think my sister very occasionally has gone down a Twitter wormhole and got annoyed that people, that, you know, are rude about me, and I'm just like, just don't look at it. It's not an issue.
What does your sister do?
Works in sales.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was actually, you know, she was really musical and quite performative actually growing up, but just didn't go down that route. I think it's interesting. I think actually writing in The Guardian, you know, that's the first time like my friends actually noticed that I've actually done anything, right? Given that's sort of the demographic that most of them are. I'd say for my family, it has made almost no difference, I think. I don't think, you know in like X Factor when, you know, after judges' houses, they go back and like the family, the whole family there with balloons and T-shirts and whatever. Just have this image that if I'd been a singer and I'd got back home, like my mum would have been in the garden and my dad would be reading a book and I'd be like, I've got through to judges' houses, and he'd literally have looked up and gone, that's nice, and then back. Like they're proud, but they would never say it.
Right.
I think. You know, now they know, like, I think my dad's just pleased that he sees it's a form of employment that I seem to be being asked to do.
Yeah. And you wrote that brilliant article around the Champions League final about watching it with your dad. That was for The Guardian, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you get any sense that he enjoyed the kind of notoriety or, you know,
a slight semblance of being
involved?
I think he likes being sort of, he likes being centre of attention in his own world.
Okay.
He had no, and it was actually really funny. I had a ticket for the Champions League final. Now, my dad is a huge Tottenham fan, and he didn't want to, he's 81 now, but he didn't want to go to
Madrid.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if I could have got him another ticket. And so I remember after we knocked out Ajax in the semi-final, sort of waking up feeling really kind of nostalgic for what football meant to me, which was all about my relationship with my dad. And that is true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And really feeling like I needed to watch it with him, even though we haven't really watched Tottenham games together for years because I'm in London and he's in Cambridge. But after every game, he'll ring me up and tell me how good Jimmy Greaves was. And it's just sort of, I just sort of felt this kind of nostalgic, that's where I need to be.
Yeah.
And so if you write an article that says, I love football, I love my dad, of course it's going to resonate with a lot of people. It's sort of an easy win, right? But I actually wrote it without being asked to write it. I sent it to the sports editor because I'd sort of said, I wouldn't mind doing a bit of writing. And then they published it and it went really, like, it obviously got a lot of traction because people like reading stuff like that.
Yeah.
The postscript, which I also read, was I went to Madrid, right? And I flew back on the Saturday, because I'd agreed to go for 2 days before or something. So I went out with my friends, blah, blah, and so on a Saturday morning, I'm the only person flying from Madrid to London, right?
Yeah.
I land, I've been out really late and I've got a terrible hangover and it's a blisteringly hot day and I've accidentally left my bike locked outside. My bike's been nicked. It's like, I text my dad going, all good for tonight. He's coming to London. A couple of friends are coming that I've watched all the rounds with. And I go for a nap at like 1:00. Well, I wake up at 5:00. I wake up, I've got 8 missed calls from my dad. All the trains have been cancelled from Cambridge. Mm. I'm like, he's like, I'll watch it at home. I'm like, oh, this is really bad for the narrative, right?
Yeah, I've written about this. I've got future articles to write.
Is there anything you can do? And it's like, I had to go to work on a Sunday, so I couldn't really get up to Cambridge. And I've got people coming over. So I'm like, is there anything you can do? And like, my dad's 80-year-old man that has to get the slow train to Liverpool Street, right? In like 50 degrees or whatever, once you're in a train carriage. He gets a taxi from Liverpool Street. He arrives and we're already 1-0 down because of that penalty.
20
that
seconds.
Still shouldn't be a penalty.
I've never watched it back, mate.
And then, like, we watch the game. As soon as Origi scores, I put him in an Uber back to King's Cross. That train is cancelled. He has to walk to St Pancras. He gets on a train with, like, all these utterly shit-faced people. He gets back to Cambridge at, like, 1 in the morning. The taxi queue is a mile long. He walks home. So I basically tried to kill my own dad. But I've started my writing career out of that, you know?
No, and it went viral and it was all picked up, so good
has
for him.
Has it affected my family? Yes. It forced my dad to come to watch a football match he didn't want to watch with me that he definitely wouldn't have done if I hadn't written that article. But no, it hasn't really happened.
On a really dark front, had he died, then that would have allowed a third article.
Of course, yeah.
Before we finish, just some kind of quick fire ones that we do, so kind of more pithy answers if possible.
Yeah, sure.
What's the most embarrassing thing that's happened to you because of being famous? Not the girl's story. Is there anything else that you can think of?
I mean, that's a good question. I know you want it to be pithy, but I'm just trying to think.
Well, you can wait. It can be pithy, but we can cut it in, right? Yeah.
No, I want to get the right answer. I mean, short of going into another Champions League final in like prawn sandwiches in a suit, Man United were playing Barcelona and tripping up on a curb surrounded by 1,000 Man United fans.
Right.
And they knew I was. That was pretty...
She fell over, presumably, all of that.
But I just sat on the floor for ages going, yeah, you know, what's happened?
Yeah, that's
good. I'm sure there are more embarrassing, but I can't remember them.
That's good. What's the best thing about being famous, Max?
The best thing... do you know what? The level of fame that I have is, I would say, every other day... Or probably not even, somebody stops me in the street to say, I'm listening to the pod, I really like the pod. Almost never has anyone been rude to my face.
Yeah.
And I suppose that is just a really nice level of it. Like, I can go around, do my own business, no one cares. And if somebody does stop you, it's to say hi.
Little bits of affirmation.
You know, I like what you do. And it's like, my wife's a teacher. She does a much more important job, but no one stops her in the street. It's annoying. Like, why doesn't someone stop me and go, thanks for educating?
The parents do, presumably.
Nah, not always, you know.
No, yeah, I guess that can swing both ways.
Yeah.
And the worst thing about being famous, I mean, immediately what comes to mind, obviously, is, you know, you said to your face, people are always nice, but then on, you know, when they've got the big invisible barrier of Twitter, presumably they send their abuse over all the time.
Death threats on Twitter. I mean, most of the death threats just are more like, I wish you were dead.
Yeah.
So what they're saying there is they're not actively going to come and kill me. They just hope something bad happens. So that's quite a passive thing. to the level I have, I can't think of any real net negatives. What I genuinely think...
That's nice.
If this is, you know, do you want to be famous type podcast to people... Your happiness is not dictated by that at all.
Mm.
Because, and I genuinely think if you were incredibly famous, it would be virtually impossible to be happy unless you were so grounded. And I think I've spent a lot of time with footballers and I think I'm pleased I wasn't one of them.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, that's a weird kind of fame because you reach your peak at 29. Now, I may have peaked. My friends think I peaked about 6-7 years ago.
Right.
I'm, you know, completely grey.
Banter.
Completely grey.
Friendship banter.
Yeah,
there.
Completely grey for 40, right? You know, like, I'm on the way down. But I may peak at 70. But it's not, you know, the search for happiness is not related, I don't think, to fame, if that's what it is.
Is it to success? In that you're successful at what you do. You earn a good living from it.
It's lots of different things, isn't it? Happiness. What is happiness? It's because people have different dispositions, don't you? You're born like, I'm very glass half full. I find life sort of funny.
Yeah.
So I think my general happiness probably comes... if I was an accountant, I'd probably be happy. Probably, yeah. I think. I don't know. Like, if I'd made different choices in my life.
Okay, interesting. You mentioned earlier... that you still have ambition and you still look on some other shows and things and think, I could do that, I wish I could do that. If there could be one show, one thing, one TV thing...
Yeah. Not the one show, no.
Not the one show.
I'd take it in a heartbeat, but it's not my dream.
But the dream show that you could do and it suits your personality and you see that, what is that or what would that be? What could that be?
I'd probably love a, you know, I'd probably love a big chat show.
A talk show, yeah.
Yeah. But not, but yeah, where you could be sitting, you know, I probably, you'd probably want to do the John Oliver, John Stewart stuff, but I'm probably not smart enough.
Right, yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, I that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't imagine I'd do 5 minute soliloquies down the barrel.
Yeah, monologue, opening monologues.
No. But I think something like that, like an interview show where you could have fun.
Yes. John Bishop does one, is it on W or somewhere, where he literally just, it's just chair to chair talk show.
Yeah, maybe.
I could see you doing that. Okay, good, good answer. And who's the most famous person in your phone, Max?
Oh, that's a good question.
Thank you. We've had Ralph Little said Adele, but he only got to the A's in his phone. And who else have we had? I'm now trying to remember who we've even had on this podcast at this point. But anyway, have a look. Have a look.
Yeah, and yeah. Like, I'm just turning my phone back on.
Because you're such a pro that you turned it off.
I mean, it would be really unimpressive.
That's good. Ideal. And then a final question. Knowing all that entails, I feel like I know the answer to this, but knowing all that it entails and with the benefit of hindsight, would you give up fame if you had the chance? But you still get to have the same life, same friends, same wife, same finances, etc. But you never stopped on the street and you don't get any of the negative Twitter death threats and stuff. But all the rest, would you give it up?
I just don't think I'm at a level where it would make any difference, really, any material difference. Probably not.
Max, like, you're ruining the format point of that question.
Yeah, I know, but I probably wouldn't. Like I wouldn't be doing this pod. I've had a nice time doing this. So
the answer is no. No, I accept
the answer is no.
I'm going to do my outro, and then at the end, the very end, you can tell me, because you're getting into your phone, who the most famous person in it is, or if you can find one. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Of course, you may plug anything you want that you're doing or that's coming up.
I mean, not necessarily, but the Guardian Football Weekly is...
And they can find that on all your usual podcast outlets, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc.
TalkSport, Saturdays 9 to 11, Sundays 11 to 1. I mean, I've just done 11 days straight because a lot of the other TalkSport presenters don't turn up for work. So if you switch that on, I'll probably be on.
Definitely his weekend morning show with Barry Glendening is hilarious. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please do press that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or leave us a comment and rate us. Find us on Instagram at Almost Famous the Podcast and on Twitter at Pod Almost Famous. And now we're just literally waiting for one name to come out of Max Rushton's mobile phone.
Do you want one, or do you want me to scroll through at the sort of hilarious level of fame?
I think if you want to give more than one name and show us your level, then we're definitely up for that.
Okay, here we go.
This is great for the retention and engagement of this show, because people are just going to be listening right to the end, Max, right to the very end.
Alan Brazil,
yeah.
Alan McAnally,
yeah.
Alan Pardew, Alan Smith, the other Alan Smith.
Okay, so
Alex Horn.
Any non-football based people?
There we go. Alex Horn.
Oh, yeah, Alex Horn's a good one.
Okay.
Host of, with Greg Davis.
Yeah, Taskmaster, brilliant show.
Taskmaster, brilliant, the best show, in fact.
Alistair Campbell.
Oh, very good.
Ali McCoist.
We had Alistair Campbell's daughter on the show in the first series.
I'm enjoying that. I'm going to go through till Z.
This is now a new format.
Yeah. I'm going to go through till Z and you can just fade out when you like, because quite enjoying. I've never. Andy Cole. Andy Townsend. Asmir Begovic. John Barnes.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.